Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to this last session. My name is Georgia Popplewell, and I'm a bit jet-lagged. I traveled pretty long distance to come here. But I'm absolutely delighted to be here in Linz for Ars Electronica, and I want to thank the organizers for having me here. I'm going to talk about Global Voices, the project I work for, and but I want to kick things off with a little video, first of all, and here it goes.
It's kind of, if you think about it, isn't really a big part. And this is when the funders in the room are supposed to cover their ears, please, and don't listen. But I mean, really, we're just kind of hanging out and having a good time. And I tell about where I'm from, you tell about where you're from, we talk to one another, and it's fantastic. I guess I kind of see Sammy as leading this movement. When I picture Sammy, I picture him wearing a cape for some reason, I don't know why, but a cape always comes to my head. And I picture Sammy fighting against these evil bartenders around the world who aren't letting people participate in our party.
Okay. So what happened there? Anyway, that was my friend and colleague David Sasaki, and you probably missed the beginning of his that clip there, where David was basically likening Global Voices to a party. And at the risk of perpetuating a stereotype about the Caribbean, where I'm from, I want to borrow David's metaphor, but I want to expand it a bit and call Global Voices a party within a party. The bigger party, of course, being party that takes place there in the greater world. Now, in Trinidad and Tobago, where I come from, there's this phenomenon. It's called the all-inclusive party, and that's one of them there. And the funny thing is that it's actually called all-inclusive, but it actually isn't inclusive at all. In fact, all-inclusive parties exclude many people by, you know, having high admission fees and things like that, and some of them even have these VIP sections where, you know, you can only go if you have a special ticket. And when you, on photo sharing sites, for instance, when the coverage of these events emerges, who gets the attention? You find that the people who get the attention are people like people who pay to come to the parties and be noticed. People who look good. And also people who deliberately draw attention to themselves with things like interesting hairstyles, just by, you know, posing for the camera, or like exhibitionists, people who do things like that. So what I've just described is a highly simplistic, but I don't think an inaccurate description of the way the world and the traditional media, newspapers, television, broadcast, radio, work. For instance, this map shows New York Times coverage in 2007 of various parts of the world, with the red indicating parts of the world that received high volumes of coverage, and the yellow indicating parts of the world that received very little coverage. And you see there's lots of red in North America, there's quite a bit of red in Western Europe, there's China. Sub-Saharan Africa, lots of yellow. Central Asia, lots of yellow. South America, lots of yellow. And then there's some orange in, you know, Western Australia, that kind of thing. So, but what is the big deal about media attention? Why should we want to be noticed by the media? Why should a small country, you might think sometimes it might be good not to be noticed. But the point about media attention is that, and here I'm quoting Ethan Zuckerman, who's one of the co-founders of the Global Voices Project. And Ethan says that when you're not paying attention to a country, you don't trade with a country, you don't send relief to a country, and you don't have to intervene when the time comes to do so. And of course, there are numerous examples of cases where people just did not have, you enough information. Rwanda, for instance, where they were, then there was coverage coming out of Rwanda, but it just was not on the radar of the public, and certain governments didn't have an interest in intervening there. So, but before the arrival of the internet, and notably of the simple tools that allowed people to start publishing easily, the problem of media attention wasn't an easy one to solve. And it was even difficult even to consider tackling it, far less trying to solve it. However, enter the phenomenon of weblogs or blogs. With millions of people all over the world writing about what was happening in their daily lives. These are images of some blogs. That one's from Cuba. She's pretty famous. And suddenly the task of piecing together a more accurate, more nuanced, and more inclusive picture of the world suddenly seems doable. Because suddenly, here are all these new voices. These new participants in the global conversation, challenging the images and ideas, in many cases, that the traditional media was presenting about their countries. And in some cases, voices who weren't even heard at all, from countries that received very little coverage. All right, so the task was doable, but maybe not as doable as you think, for several reasons. For instance, there are a lot of blogs out there. There are millions. I don't even know the figure these days, but it used to be 40 million was the figure cited. It's probably like tripled by now. And again, if you're reading about a blog from a country that you don't know about, how do you know that what the blogger is saying is reliable? How do you know it's true? Why should you trust that information? Another thing, what if the blog with the best information is written in a language you don't understand? How do you get around that? And that's where Global Voices comes in. If Global Voices was started by Ethan Zuckerman and Rebecca McKinnon, who were then both fellows at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. And what they noticed was that, yes, there was all this information being generated daily, very valuable information, by people all over the world. But because of the reasons I outlined before, a lot of it was inaccessible, especially to people who spoke English. Because the English language might be kind of hegemonic on the internet, but you know, the majority of bloggers probably aren't writing in English. So here's how Global Voices tackled the problem. The first one, volume. The way that we deal with the volume of blogs is basically not too different from the way the mainstream media deals with information. We have a newsroom of sorts. It's a completely virtual newsroom. I sit in Trinidad and I manage the project. I'm managing editors in New York. Editors and authors are all over the world. But basically, our editors and authors are reading blogs from their regions every day. There are about 20 regional editors, regional and language editors, and about 100 authors at this point. And they are filtering that information and selecting what they believe to be the most interesting or valuable. And yes, of course, it's not a perfect system. But we aren't gatekeepers in the sense that for instance, editors of newspapers are, because this information is actually, it's out there. It's just that we're helping to filter it. But it's accessible to anyone who wants it because it's on the internet. All right. And we also choose editors and authors who we know their regions well, are passionate about their regions, either because they're native to that region or because they've been lived there or have a kind of academic interest. But basically, our editors are people with, you know, either natives or with an interest in the region. Next, the issue of context. I don't know much about the country, so how do I know that the blogger that's writing about that country can be trusted? As I said, editors and authors are chosen for their knowledge of the regions concerned, and therefore they can assess the reliability of the information. These are people who are, you know, reading the daily news from their country, so can give a bit of context. And for instance, as an example, this is Amira Al-Husseini. Amira is our Middle East editor, and she's from Bahrain and we're currently living in Canada. which is a former journalist. And last but not least, what if a blog is written in a language I don't understand? And that's where all language editors come in. Our language editors are following blogs written in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Russian, Spanish, French, Portuguese, Persian, and Arabic. And they are summarizing that information in English. For instance, here's a post about China and some Chinese bloggers. But actually, this is on the site right now. Very, very recent story. And there's also the situation where we translate blogs into different languages. We used to be accused in the early days of being global, but English language. And a lot of people said, you know, you can't say you're really global if you're only in English. And our solution to that, which actually grew up very organically out of discussions in the community, was to set up a series of translation sites. And we are now translating the English language content from Global Voices into 16 languages, with about 3 languages kind of in hibernation, Serbian, Swahili, and there's a third I can't remember, Russian actually. We're going to be doing Russian. So here's some of the language sites. It's Macedonian, for instance. That's Malagasy, the language of Madagascar. That's actually, we were actually quite surprised to learn that so many people spoke this language, and it was one of the fastest growing sites. And we have a very, very vibrant community of natives of Madagascar translating for this site. There's German. And that's Hindi. And that's Arabic. And Italiano. And that's Farsi. So what Global Voices does is basically attempt to amplify voices and topics rarely covered or covered in completely by traditional media. And of course, a lot of that is politics. Sometimes some of the bloggers in our community who are interested in arts and culture, for instance, say that we have a bias towards politics, but that's kind of understandable given what the kind of immediate needs of the world are right now. So this is the main site, and if I wanted to return to David's metaphor of Global Voices as a party, I'd probably call this the dance floor, because this is where we are linking to bloggers who are already kind of writing, which means that they already have computers, they already have internet access. And one thing you notice if you look at what's happening on this part of the Global Voices project is that a lot of the bloggers, even though they're from different countries, they kind of look the same. These are people who have the means to do this, which means they have some leisure, they have some equipment. And it's one of the accusations leveled commonly at the blogosphere is that it's elitist. So we couldn't live with that. So what we did, we got some funding from the Knight Foundation to start this section of the site. It's called Rising Voices. And my colleague David Sasaki, he's the director of outreach for the site. And what Rising Voices does is to use the party metaphor again, invite more people to the party so they can be part of the conversation. People who can't afford the prices of admission, people who can't afford the equipment. So what Rising Voices does is offer micro-grants, usually of around no more than 5,000 US, to projects which demonstrate that they are giving increased access to these tools to communities that didn't have them before. And here's one of the projects that we're funding in Bangladesh, for instance. David, actually, this video shot just last week because David was in Bangladesh. This project is it's called Nari Jibon, and it's a project that offers women skills that would allow them to be more employable. And they've actually integrated citizen media into their project work in an environment where David was saying that, for hours a day they don't have electricity, but they've done an incredible amount of work just using resources. It's dial-up, those don't look like very new computers. But here they are in a very, very poor country in the world. And this is one of the, this is Taslima, one of the project leaders. And she's actually talking here about starting her blog. It's a shame we can't hear her.
Then I can get an idea how to blog.
All right. Rising Voices has funded projects in I think now about, we've had three cycles, probably about 12 countries in the world, including Kenya, Sierra Leone, Bolivia. We actually have an incredible project in Bolivia called Voces Bolivianas, which basically expanded the Bolivian blogosphere several times just by a series of workshops that have kind of replicated themselves throughout the country. They've also, in the context of Voces Bolivianas, the first blog in Aymara, one of the indigenous languages, was created. And recently, Voces Bolivianas had a kind of Bolivia-wide day where communities, different communities, held workshops and spread the blogging thing even more. So you have an entirely new population of people in Bolivia now having a voice because they have access to these tools. All right. Another obstacle preventing people from having access to the internet and being heard is, of course, when the government doesn't want them to say certain things. And Global Voices Advocacy, which is funded by the Dutch NGO HIVOS, was developed in 2007 with the aim of documenting instances of attacks on online freedom of speech. You'll see, for instance, a story about Malaysia there where there's a defamation case against a blogger. Imagine that. And also there's a story of murder. That's kind of rare, but this does happen. And in addition to documenting, Global Voices Advocacy also teaches people how to circumvent blocks that are put on the internet by governments. You'll see in the corner there's a guide called Anonymous Blogging with WordPress and Tor. Anonymous blogging is critical for people in some countries where, you know, they're not free to put their names to things they write for fear of repercussions. And here's a... How do I go back? Anyway, that was a map. I'm sorry. I went... How do I go backwards? Ah, there you go. That's a map that that Sami Bengabia, the advocacy director, created, where he keeps track of different parts of the world that are being kind of threatened by censorship and attacks on freedom of speech. And it's basically a Google map mashup, and you can search it either by, you know, the projects where activists are working or by country. So that's on the Global Voices Advocacy site. So Global Voices was developed, in other words, to bring us closer to realizing one of the great promises of the internet, which was the promise of a more inclusive, more global conversation. And we use open source tools, you know, completely. The blog, the Global Voices site, which is essentially a blog, is a WordPress blog, very heavily hacked, and you know, about a million plugins on top of it. And we distribute our content under a Creative Commons license. So at nearly 4 years old, we find that we have created a space for ourselves in the global media ecosystem. Journalists come to the site to look for leads all the time. Reuters is one of our sponsors, actually. And agencies like Reuters and the BBC are constantly calling us whenever they're breaking news stories to say, you know, is there a blogger in South Ossetia, which, you know, actually happened, that we can talk to. And having linked to that blogger, we'd be able to kind of put them in touch. And we've also become a fertile platform for innovation. And here I want to draw attention particularly to our language sites, the translations we're doing. We kind of thought we were doing something pretty ordinary by translating this content using a kind of distributed team method. To just translate the content. It turned out that David and a few other people from the project went to Croatia to a Conference on Translation last year, and it was kind of held up as this example of something pretty incredible, because machine translation is, you know, a long way from replacing the human ability to translate. And apparently we've worked out a pretty good system of translating contents. We've also created a structure that combines elements of the traditional media model. You know, we do have a newsroom of sorts. And it's not, we're not an open project in the sense that we're open to any user apart from comments, and that's quite deliberate. With advanced open kind of methods of doing things. As I said, we're completely distributed. This is the kind of system. I mean, 10 years ago, a project like Global Voices could not be run from Trinidad for all sorts of reasons. Internet access, how would somebody have found me, for instance? But turns out I was found on the internet. That's how I got involved in this project. So we've hacked and bent different kinds of models in order to come up with this system we have here. And this hasn't been an easy task. We've had to figure out, for instance, how to keep a largely volunteer community sufficiently motivated to produce content according to schedule. For instance, because of the nature of this, the news cycle, so to speak, of the blogosphere, people have to be reading blogs all the time. When breaking news situations arise, very often we have the BBC calling and saying, "Do you have anybody on the ground?" And we're like, "No, that's not how it works. You know, we actually don't have people on the ground. We have people writing about people on the ground." And that's been a huge and actually quite delightful challenge, creating this incredible community that's based largely on trust. We only meet in person once a year at our annual summit. This year we had the summit in Budapest, and for most of us it was the first time we were kind of meeting our colleagues, and just there's incredible magic that takes place when we do kind of get together. We're also grappling with some questions that I think have to do with the global nature of our community. Now, a lot of the theorizing around sharing seems to me to have been kind of apply more to fairly homogeneous communities. And when you have a situation where there are people from, you know, different parts of the world where, you know, variances in global economies, you start to kind of wonder, how do I motivate the person, for instance, who has to go to an internet cafe to file a story? You know, as opposed to the person who's sitting at home with, you know, an ADSL connection. There's actually an ongoing discussion in the translation communities about compensation and money, and we're kind of wondering, what would be the effect of introducing money into a volunteer community? Is it going to destroy some of the kind of goodwill, for instance? Will people join only for the money? And is that a problem? Is that a problem if people are coming in? Another thing, and it was something that Isaac Mao raised this morning when we were kind of took a walk out towards the Ars Electronica office, was about geography. Right now the site is organized according to region. And one of the kind of hopes we'd had for Global Voices when it was first started is that there'd be a lot of cross-regional dialogue, that people from, say, you know, Kazakhstan would be reading about blogs in Jamaica and developing interest and developing relationships across the lines. And that hasn't been as simple as you think. So we're kind of wondering now, you know, is there another way we should be looking at the world? Is the nation state a kind of viable thing? Maybe topics might be more interesting. But we do have some interesting projects that started up by just community members saying that, you know, they wanted to do certain things. And there's a cross-regional Asian mailing list that we have right now where people are meeting by IRC and inviting bloggers from the outside to come in and talk about issues going on in their countries. And I think they've had one IRC so far, and I think it's something that we'll probably see replicated. So what's more about it? I want to draw your attention now to another project that's funded by Reuters. This is just voices without votes. And what Voices Without Votes is doing is tracking what bloggers in different parts of the world are saying about the U.S. election. And it's actually been quite a successful project because, as you know, there's an unprecedented level of interest in this U.S. election. So that's the thing. I don't know if any of the candidates has ever visited this site, but we should really find out. So yeah, so that's Global Voices in a nutshell. It's I think I have about 6 minutes, and because I have to leave, I'd like to take some questions. I know it's not always apparent just by looking at screenshots of the site how we work. So please feel free to ask me any questions about the inner workings or how we're funded or anything like that. Thank you. Yes.
Microphone.
I wanted to ask a question about censorship and the consequences. Mm-hmm. Because you say you publish if there is a blocking of certain sites.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can.
Did you also have some consequences for the writers of the blogs that you are aware of, or how do you then follow up? Because this is very interesting also for the ongoing processes in international relations.
Yes, no, absolutely.
In China, for example, which I have lots of addresses that get blocked then.
Right. No, they're actually, when it comes to consequences, we do think very carefully before reporting an issue. There was one instance where a blogger in Saudi Arabia, who Sami Ben-Gabia, our director, knew personally, and he'd actually given Sami the password for his blog and gave him the authority to kind of shut it down, to update it. But Sami consulted with his wife first before saying anything because it might have actually been more dangerous for her. So, it's a big thing. We completely respect the right, and some people wonder why anonymity is something desirable, but we completely respect the right. We think it's one of the rights of bloggers to kind of protect the information. But these days in the blogosphere, information gets out so quickly, however, and people also have an interest in getting information about violations out very quickly. There have been a few cases recently where people have used Twitter to kind of announce to the public, you know, I'm being arrested, and it's made a world of difference. So it is a fine balance, you know, do we want more information or less? And it's a case-by-case thing, but we are very, very sensitive to the fact that sometimes reporting an incident may be worse, depending on the way the government responds to pressure. Some governments cave in and others say, you know, who do you think you are? Yes, of course.
Hello, I think what you're doing is very fascinating, but on the other side, you asked what is the way in which you are financed today, and in which way do you believe that you can go on being financed in a way that wouldn't be too controllable? When I hear you, you know, I'm not one of the youngest in this group. That's why I remember a moment where we believed in Europe that there was going to be free radio, and it ended up in commercial radio. Mm-hmm. I hear now that you have Reuters, which of course are goodwill people. They don't want any money for anything. But of course they hope that there'll be some more democracy. That means places where they can sell their news, mm-hmm. Okay? So how do you see the transition from now on to the next stop?
Well, we actually are. That's one of the big questions we're grappling with. That's why I suggested that as something you should ask. We're currently seeking foundation funding because it's just I don't think anybody has yet found a business model that that kind of fits with the kind of sharing economy around blogging. And because our community is so rarefied in a way globally, advertising isn't as much of an option for us. So we are looking, certainly in the short term, at foundation funding because it would gives us the most freedom. The corporate thing, Reuters actually came to us. You know, it's funny, this at a conference like this, someone was having a conversation with Reuters and mentioned the project, and they said, oh, you know, this is 2005, when blogging is in its young adulthood, not infancy. And they're like, oh, blogging, we need to get a blogging property. So they got us. The good thing about the relationship with Reuters is that it's actually a pretty lightweight relationship. And we'd actually like to give them more. And we're working with them to kind of figure out ways of using our content. Media outlets like the BBC have been, you know, much more successful in a way at using Global Voices. They kind of understand a little better why, you know, a blogger might give you better information in the, you know, kind of that space where between the breaking news and the point at which the journalist gets parachuted in. So, but yeah, no, I take your point that not all money is neutral. I mean, no money is neutral. What am I saying? Sorry? No, I'm not neutral. No, I don't pretend to be. Yes?
I think what you're doing is very admirable. I live in Northern Ireland, where mm-hmm. people are shooting each other lots of the times from different sides of the equations. What slightly worries me about what you're doing is that it's the whole kind of aspect of picking somebody who is knowledgeable about an area when an area is very, very complex. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually from Northern Ireland. I'm from Hong Kong, and I've lived there for 15 years. I don't purport to know too much about the place, although my children live there now. It's a very complex place, picking that as an example. Yeah. And I worry about something called Global Voices, which possibly should be local voices. How do you know, I understand what you're saying when you say you pick people on the ground who are knowledgeable, but how do you pick people on the ground who are knowledgeable but also objective and not subjective and bring their own opinions to that?
Oh yeah, that's something we grapple with all the time, and there is if you read the articles in Global Voices, you'd see that just by virtue of selecting, there's a kind of inherent kind of filtering that's going on. But we pick people who have kind of reputations in the blogosphere usually. All of our editors and authors are bloggers, so normally we would have watched them over time to see the way that they approach subjects. Again, it's just like, you know, how do you pick a journalist who is, you know, who's objective? I don't think the questions are too different. We also don't claim that we're doing journalism, and we're giving information that's sometimes complementary to journalism. There are times when it approaches journalism, but we don't use the term citizen journalism deliberately. We tend to say citizen media for that reason. But no, I take your point. I mean, it's in any given situation, what you're trying to do is get as many different voices and points of view as possible. That's not always possible, because not everybody on all sides, you know, is necessarily blogging. But you have a situation like in Egypt where you have the Muslim Brotherhood blogging, you know, as strenuously as Kifaya, the opposition. And that makes for some very interesting dialogue. But basically, we do acknowledge that our agenda is set by the blogosphere.
I take that point, and I just want to say as well that I think what you're doing is very courageous and quite interesting.
Thank you.
So don't take it as a criticism.
Oh, no, not at all. No, I you know, criticism is very useful. And no, it's something that we grapple with, and the question is raised often, and it really has to do with the fact that we could be better at covering. We always could. There are blogs growing up every day, and they're which is why we actually have a system where people can send us information and submit blogs that we don't know about. But it's as imperfect a science as journalism, really. Thanks, though. That was good.
I think this is the last question for...
Um,
What about the situation if free translation software is available for everybody online and everybody could speak in her or his own language and is translated simultaneously by software? What's the role of Global Voice then? Is it obsolete then? Will it be obsolete? Or?
Well, the moment there's a perfect machine translation system, our translation section is dead. But I think that moment is far away. We actually wish it were closer. We're constantly looking at tools. There are tools that help with translation. And there are collaborative translation tools that we've tested. But thus far, they're all pretty much kind of in the early stages of development. But unless you know, do you know of an example that's...
example, but I read about I got a message about Google that they are employing translators to increase the possibilities.
Yeah, they're employing humans. Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, no.
It goes this direction, I think, because for me it's real diversity. If everybody can speak in her own language and participate, nevertheless in a global speech, that's
right.
Diversity for me.
Right, but that was the goal of the translation sites, that we're trying to translate our content into as many languages as possible so it's more accessible. And trying to we're looking at key languages as well, because in certain blogospheres, for instance, the Serbian blogosphere, our Serbian author came to us the other day and said, I want to do Serbian. So we said, yeah, great, you know, start a Serbian site. We've set up a site, and we're kind of hoping it gets going, because in Serbia, there are a lot of people who are not going to be able to read the content unless it's in their language. So that is something, but of course, when it's done by humans, it's a little slower than machines, but I would welcome perfect machine translation any day, because it's a lot cheaper than humans. I don't have to motivate them, motivate a machine.
And I'm going to use the moderator's prerogative just to add one thing, which is really good machine translation is only going to come after we have a huge corpus of translated material, and it's really these human translators that are going to be the key to creating an open translation system. And your team is probably going to be at the center of an effective open translation system. So I think they'll just turn into the custodians of the machine translation system.
Hope so. Yeah, we actually do get a lot of requests from people when they're looking for, say, a video to be subtitled in several different languages. The most efficient way right now seems to be to come to Global Voices and say, "Can your team do it?" Because there are a few other places with the variety of languages, the capabilities that we have, apparently. And we were very surprised to learn that, believe me. Sometimes you think you're doing something that's fairly ordinary, and it turns out to be remarkable.
Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you.